Hello, this is the Overtones Podcast, a show about the beauty of diversity within Christianity today. I'm Joe, and I'm a church worker.
I'm Christy, and I'm a church historian.
And I'm Lorraine, and I'm a Christian teacher. On our show, we talk to academics, professionals, and full-time church workers to explore lesser-heard voices that are shaping the church today.
Listen with us, and this season we'll explore how Puritans coped with same-sex attraction in 17th century America, how Taiwanese evangelical preaching addressed the presidential election in 2024, the unique challenges to evangelism facing Korean city churches, the changing perception and pastoral support for single women in the UK, and more.
Yeah, so basically I grew up kind of going to church in high school and going to youth groups and stuff, but I suppose looking back, it was mainly for like social reasons. I went to an all-girls school, so that was also the only time to really hang out with boys. And then when I went to university, I really drifted away in undergrad. I think I went to church for like a few weeks, and then, you know, everything else kind of just grabbed my attention. There was just so many social things going on. Obviously, uni work was really demanding. And yeah, I think I would kind of drift through the days and people would know that I was a Christian because I think I would occasionally mention going to church like back when I was younger, but I really didn't live as if going to church or being a Christian meant anything to me. And then when I came to Oxford after I got my offer and deciding to come here for a PhD, again, it felt very kind of, well, I mean, in hindsight, it's kind of God putting it all together because I was just like, oh yeah, I would apply. And then if I get a scholarship, I'll come. And then surprise, I think God was very generous and lined up all of that for me. And I arrived in Oxford kind of 2 weeks before term started. And there wasn't a whole lot going on at the time because it was before term, kind of end of the summer. People still weren't back yet. But at St. Ebb's, they still had summer thesis, which is the Bible study that kind of runs over the break. And so I remember, Googling at first to see what kind of churches there were, especially ones that had student activities. Because I just felt kind of, a calling to go back to God's people in a way. And I just remember turning up to summer thesis. We were doing Psalms and I'm kicking myself that I don't remember which Psalm it is because I do tell this story quite a bit and I never remember which Psalm it is. It was just the first time like that I remember doing a Bible study where I felt very intellectually engaged because we were doing kind of, you know, typical St. Ebb's like textual analysis in a way on it. And it really just felt like this penny drop moment where I was like, this is amazing. I want to do more of this. I feel so intellectually stimulated and satisfied. And I think that's how I want to engage with scripture and with God. Obviously not the only way, but I think that kind of, I was reflecting back on this and I think that's a way that like God really moves me, you know. I think it's through my mind and it's not, it's sure, like there's other experiences as well. I think it's different for everyone, but I think God has given people brilliant minds and I think we should be able to use them to engage with God. And it's just such a joy to be able to do that.
Welcome to another episode of the Overtones Podcast. We're delighted to have Kay Song with us today, a material scientist based in Oxford, and she's going to be talking with us about her research on nuclear power and why it matters to her as a Christian scientist. So join us. So, hello Kay. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Who are you and what do you do in Oxford?
Yeah, so I am just finishing a PhD at the moment from the Department of Engineering Science. My PhD was working on materials for nuclear fusion power, specifically looking at how we can make better steels, which will be used in the structural components. And now I'm a postdoc for the year, still in nuclear power, but switching over to nuclear fission, actually, and looking at an element called zirconium, which is used to hold the fuel that's in existing fission reactors and trying to just, figure out how they're damaged by being in their operating environment, which has a lot of heat and a lot of irradiation. And if we can better understand their properties that way, then we can know their lifetimes and reduce waste. Because at the moment, we're kind of taking them out prematurely because we don't want them to break. But as a result, we're probably also not getting full use out of them, and we can't really recycle them. So it's just producing a lot more waste than we probably need to.
It sounds like you've practiced this so many times, telling people about your research.
Oh, the zirconium part's actually the first time I've ever told it. But thank
you.
Oh,
wow.
Not to brag.
Maybe to the mirror, like 32 times.
Yeah, true. The first time I've told other people.
It doesn't even sound like a real element. It sounds like something from Wakanda or something. I don't know. That sounds great. Zirconium.
Zirconium, yeah. Okay, cool.
It's great. Well, tell us, why are you doing this research? Kind of, why is it important that you do this? Why do you care? And kind of, why should we care as well?
I love that you ask it from that angle, because I totally didn't go into this research being like, I'm going to change the world. I went into this because I was just excited about material science. And to be honest, I kind of stumbled into nuclear power in a way, because in my undergrad, I had to do some research projects as a part of my degree. And I had something lined up to do like solar cells or something. And then it fell through. And so I was scrambling last minute to find something. And I happened to speak to a professor whose class I was taking at the time, who was really, really kind and just showed me around his lab, and he was working in nuclear. And so that's kind of how I got into it. But I also do think that it is really important that we talk about nuclear, because as you know, our world is heating up from man-made climate change. That's hopefully not disputable amongst here. Or at least I don't think it is. But we should do something about it. And we need to look for better, cleaner energy sources. And we have renewables. We have some renewables such as solar or wind or, hydro. But the problem with a lot of those is that when the sun doesn't come out or when the wind starts blowing, what do? And we need some form of what's called dispatchable power, so you can turn it off and on when you want to, as opposed to relying on external sources. So to have that as the baseline, then you can sort of fully go off the reliance on fossil fuels and all of that. So that's where nuclear comes in. So it's not a competition to renewables, but it's complementary, I would say. And currently we do have a decent amount of fission power. So for example, the UK has 15% fission. So it's not a small amount by any means, but there's also a lot of fear and just kind of misguided understanding around nuclear. I feel like sort of two of the key events as I've been kind of growing as a researcher in nuclear is the release of the TV show Chernobyl and more recently Oppenheimer. So it's always a fun topic of conversation when you're telling people you do nuclear. They're like, oh, you know, I watched Chernobyl recently. You're like, oh, great. Okay, this is where we're starting our conversation. And actually, when I was applying for a scholarship, which will remain unnamed, one of the panelists asked me about, you know, my research and everything, and explicitly told me that, oh, we read nuclear in your application, and I had to force myself to keep reading because it was just so off-putting.
Oh, my.
This would be a scholarship interview. Exactly. So, you know, that gives you a little bit of a feel of some of the misguided notions out there. So I think that's why I like to talk about it. You know, thank you for the opportunity to talk about this as well here. But yeah, I think it's really important from a climate perspective and also, sort of public science awareness.
Yeah, thank you, Kay. I do think this is quite a relevant topic in East Asia as well. I'm Taiwanese, and we know that in places like Japan and Taiwan, whether to use or expand the use of nuclear power has become a deeply political and divisive topic. And you mentioned environment, and I think recently it's over the news, right? Like how they're considering releasing polluted water at a Fukushima plant, and everyone's like just a little bit worried. And I think since the is it 2011 earthquake, there has been a lot of conversation about whether we should stop exploring and expanding nuclear power in Taiwan. And every year when there's an election, then this is an important talking point. And I think that's at least partly why people in Taiwan, in Japan, people still talk about this as a potential threat to our environment. And you've mentioned this. I wonder how you address concerns like this when we've seen the damage on TV.
I think it's right in some ways to consider it. I hesitate to say be concerned, because I think, you know, safety is huge. I guess the thing with existing nuclear power, with nuclear fission, is that, you know, if something goes wrong, it does really go wrong. it's rare for things to go really wrong, but that doesn't mean safety isn't like a super, super high level consideration, one of the highest. I think it's funny because for the past few years, I've been doing fusion, which I'm not sure if people completely understand the difference sometimes. And it's that, well, so we don't have nuclear fusion yet. We have nuclear fission. And it's confusing because the words sound really, really similar and my accent probably not helping. Fission is the one that does have the radioactive waste. And there's obviously always a lot of research into how we can safely manage that. Fusion doesn't to the same extent. It doesn't have the long-lived radioactive waste that lasts for like hundreds of thousands of years. It produces neutrons and helium. So I always tell people it's like a glorified helium balloon factory. So that's kind of the main selling point. I think that's made it a lot easier to sell fusion as a concept and as a thing that we should pursue. I think everything comes with, pros and cons. What does burning coal and fossil fuels not harm the environment? Or when you think about solar, yes, it's really good in terms of not generating carbon dioxide, but the raw materials are actually quite toxic. So it's just something that we all have to weigh up. And the technology has improved leaps and bounds in nuclear. But the problem is it, you know, takes quite a lot of money to build a plant. And you have a lot of existing nuclear power plants, which have quite old technology. So it's constantly thinking about how do we, you know, dismantle them safely and build new ones and sort of the cost benefit that comes with it as well. So I think it's, yeah, like I said, it's important to keep in mind everything has pros and cons.
Absolutely.
Well, you told us in your story at the beginning of this podcast that you're a Christian. So how does that kind of interplay with your research? So how does it affect your or reflect your identity as a Christian as you work in research? Give us some of your reflections from how you found that.
Yeah, I think broadly as a scientist, you know, as I mentioned before, God has given people these minds to be curious, to explore his creation and to be curious about how he's put everything together, you know, sort of tinkering with the parts that he's put here, discovering how this creator has set everything in place and still sustains it. I think it's just so amazing to be able to think about that and pull that apart and to be able to explore and to play. I think also specifically for my area, looking at clean energy, it also goes a little bit into our roles as humans to steward his creation. And we haven't been doing that very well because of many reasons, key one being the fall and all its ramifications. And yeah, we haven't taken good care of his planet. It's getting hot, it's getting polluted. And I think it's, yeah, our responsibility to find a way to do a better job. And I think clean energy is one of the ways to do that. So I think to be able to participate in that with my research is really exciting. To be honest, it's not a thing that for me personally, when I sit at my desk every day, is at the forefront of my mind. And that might be sort of a reflection we can talk about later as well. But it's really nice every now and then, such as doing a podcast like this, to be able to stand back and think, why am I doing this? I mean, don't get me wrong. I do see where God does play in my research. And I think that's more on like a day-to-day problem solving, challenging, specific challenges type of thing. But I think, yeah, being a Christian does affect why we're doing this as well. And for me, I would say that's why.
That's really good. Tell us more about whether you have any specific like reflections or kind of inspiration when you do a research and how that helps you know God a bit more.
Yeah, sure. So this week in particular, I am kind of 2 weeks into my postdoc. And as I mentioned, it's still in nuclear, but it's in a different material. But I am using a lot of like similar techniques. And so I've been really challenged this week how some things, it just feels like it should be easy because I've done it before. And it's not. And I don't know why. And this week has been really hard. And I think it's just, you know, I stepped back and I was like, I think it's because I went into the week thinking, okay, this is where I am. This is where I'm going to go. It's like I see a point in the distance and I'm just marching towards it being like, what can go wrong? Turns out many things. And I think it's just a really humbling thing and a very kind reminder in a way from God of saying, you need to give this work over to me as well. And I really struggle to do that. And I think maybe it's an ego thing, a pride thing. You just feel like, you know, this is my research. People tell you it's your thing. What are you going to do about it? And so it's just in your head, like, I am in control. I am going to do X, Y, Z. Whereas that's not how it works. And I think it's easy sometimes to think about that in our personal lives or when you talk about, like, church topics or something like that. And to be honest, I don't talk about my work at church all that often because I do it and I just want to talk about something else to kind of decompress. Sure. And so maybe that's why it's hard for me so far to be able to link my work and how to give that over to God, because I see that as kind of like my own little thing. I'm going to keep it in this sphere over here. Don't you come over and touch it because I've got this under control. And I really don't. So I think that's where I've been really challenged this week, sort of on like the small things. Small, in quotes. Not small. Not small to him.
That's really encouraging to hear. Do you still get, I feel like this is less common now than it was a few years ago, but do you often get people saying, oh, faith and science, they're incompatible. How can you be a person of faith and an actual scientist? Do you find that at all?
I think I've been really blessed that in my work, specifically in my lab, there's been Christian presence and discussions. You know, actually one of the first few months of being in Oxford, one of the postdocs who was still working at the time here, he's since moved on to Canada, unfortunately. I really miss him. He was really good at his work, but also more importantly, he's a Christian. I just remember one day working with him in the lab and something wasn't working as usual. What's new? And he was like, okay, why don't we pray? So I took a step. I was like, whoa, I've never done that before in the lab. And it was just, you know, that makes it sound like, oh, you know, we only pray when things aren't working. I don't think that's what we should be doing. But it was just, yeah, such a good reminder that God is everywhere and he's always in control. And yeah, sort of he cares about all things, great and small. But sort of to your point about, do people still feel like they're incompatible? You know, I haven't really had discussions with my colleagues or other people in science where they've been like, oh, how can you believe in this? I think maybe part of it is just that we don't talk about things like this in the workplace because it might be perceived as unprofessional. I get a more general sense. It's not so, you know, I think people are like, oh, cool, you go to church. Like, good for you. That sounds really nice. I know other people who go to church. They all seem very nice. I don't think people think you're, you know, dumb or something for believing in God. I think the problem more so is that they don't see it as something that's relevant to them. They kind of see it as, okay, good for you. You have this like spiritual guide and you can sort of comfort yourself. Like that's all very well, but I don't need that. Maybe also in academia that people are just so busy that there isn't time for anything else as well. You know, I see a lot of like professors around me and I really do wonder between work and oftentimes family and or maybe other things. How do you fit other things in, especially if it's something you don't feel like you need in a way, you don't have a crisis absolutely in your life. Why do I need God? I think that's where people are at. Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
I think that's very true. I think in science and in other workplaces as well, it's almost like if you're a Christian, well, keep it to yourself. Don't talk about faith in the office because it's so unprofessional, like you said. And I think it is related to what you said about Christianity being irrelevant rather than unscientific. And I think that's the difference between this 18th, 19th century and 21st century. I think back in the day, the clash between science and Christianity seems a difficult problem to solve, something to address, because we're still living in a time when we recognize an objective reality. We understand that there are truths out there, they're objective. Whereas I think in this day and age, everything is relative, and to claim any objective truth seems to be very unfashionable, if not morally wrong. And that makes it extra hard to, in some way, theologize our work, let alone in public. And I think that plays out in the way we approach faith in public. And in a place like science, it has become irrelevant. Like, if that's your truth, that's your truth. Yeah. It might not be mine, and we have to all respect our privacy.
Yeah, and I guess it's really interesting going back to why universities were set up to do research, especially in the sciences, because, as you said, Kay, kind of God is in everything, and he's made everything. And so behind the things that we see is a God who is truth. And like, for example, the University of Oxford, The motto is, the Lord is my light, Dominus Illuminatio Mea. And kind of it forms the groundwork, foundation of why we even do research, because we believe that there's something behind the things that we can see. But I guess in kind of today's culture, that just passes people by because you just kind of go off of what you can see. And surely, yeah, of course, there's something to figure out about this world. But it's cool that as you, as a Christian scientist in the workplace, there is that opportunity to kind of help people maybe step back a little bit and think about, yeah, why are we doing this research? Why can we do this research and find things out? I think for me, when I was a chemist, when I was doing chemistry for my undergraduate degree, I also kind of every now and again, it passed me by because I wasn't thinking about it. But when you do take a step back and you think, oh, the heavens do declare the glory of God, and everything that I'm seeing shows me God's glory. How have you found that over the last how many years?
I just want to make a quick comment about universities and the original intention of it. I think in a way of how we're approaching research and why we're doing it, it parallels the fall in a way. You know, it first started because we want to look at God's creation. We're all looking at God. But I think especially coming from my background of being in physics and being around a lot of fundamental research in my undergrad, what I think the reasons people do fundamental research a lot of the times, or actually research in general, is just because it's interesting, because I find it interesting. Let's see what I can do. So I think in a way we've taken it to be about us again.
Yes.
As opposed to, I mean, we should be able to find it interesting, again, because we want to put it in that framework of, because God made this, isn't he amazing? But instead it's just like, yeah, let's just see what we can uncover and what we can do with it.
That's a really important point, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess it's trying to find satisfaction and contentment in the things that we can do.
Exactly.
Rather than satisfaction and contentment in the God who's made everything.
Yeah, I think there's something so beautiful about being able to step back and be like, yeah, why are we doing this? And it's because this creator who we cannot fathom in our tiny, tiny, tiny little minds has revealed himself to us in creation. And it's a creation that we can try to understand bit by bit, surely not the whole thing, but to be able to, yeah, engage with it. And I think really having this kind of picture of us like, yeah, tinkering and playing with it. And I think that brings him delight as well.
That's a beautiful picture. Am I right in thinking, Kay, that your field is still pretty heavily male-dominated?
Yes, very much so. I think there's like half a dozen people in my office. I'm the only female, and that's pretty common across the board in the building.
Right. So how has it been being an Asian Christian woman in a field like that?
Yeah, I know. I tick all the EDI boxes. Yeah, I think it swings in roundabouts in that. I remember when I first arrived in Oxford going to one of the first kind of big group meetings on nuclear power, and there was maybe about like 30 or so people in that room. And it was my first day in the building, and I looked around and I said to my supervisor, like, wow, it's a real boys club in here. And he looked around, he was like, huh, never noticed that before.
Ah, oh, wow. Typical.
Like, of course you haven't. Of course you haven't. And I think every now and then I try and challenge him a little bit on, like, you know, language. For example, it really bugs me when people try and explain like a scientific concept or like a experimental setup, and they go, and this guy does this and this guy does that. They're talking about, like, you know, the stage or a screw or a laser. And you're like, why do things have to be sort of subconsciously gendered in that way? I don't like that. I think we need to watch our language. I think I particularly have a problem with the word guys because I don't think it's gender neutral, but I'm not going to go on a whole rant about that. So I think, yeah, it subconsciously permeates everything. But then at the same time, I catch myself every now and then sort of how much of my identity is in being the only Asian or the only female scientist in the room. I think sometimes I'm too rooted in that. And then it kind of comes around that if there's someone else who has one of those identifiers, I'm like, no, I'm the only one who's like that here. You can't be here. And that's something that I've really wrestled with because I don't think that's helpful of a mindset to have, and not helpful for sort of diversity overall. I guess we need to be thinking about, why do we want there to be a more diverse field? It's because we want people with different perspectives, different types of thinking, different experiences to come in. And the end goal is to be able to do better science, I guess, because you're trying to work together. I think that's hard sometimes as well when, especially at the PhD stage, where you're doing everything kind of by yourself. Sure, you're a part of a bigger lab, but it's about what PhD can you produce? What's the work that you can do? So again, it makes you look very inwardly. And yeah, that has not very pleasant consequences, I think, for identity. And it doesn't make you want to, yeah, look at other people and think, how can I be supporting them? How can we be working together? How can we be using our differences in background and experiences actually to create something really unique and have collaborations in that way?
That's very true. And I think you're in a very unique position, it sounds like the way Larray said it, you know, female, Asian, Australian as well, and
yeah,
Christian,
yeah,
doing what you do. And what do you think are there challenges? And I wonder whether you can think of things that are good, there are things that you bring to the table as a minority. And what do you think are the unique contributions that you can bring to your office, to your lab?
Yeah, I guess it's funny. I don't think of some of the skills I have, you know, I have this because I am an Asian Christian woman in science. I think it's probably true that being those things has shaped certain traits that I have. Or recently was really encouraging because I had lunch with someone else who's in my broader research group, and we were just walking back and she started asking me about sort of my experiences during my PhD. So she's still in the midst of it at the moment. And I think she's really struggling because she's, partway through third year, feeling so unmotivated and so lonely. And she also she's also an Asian female. Don't worry, there's still enough of them that you won't be able to tell who this is just by me telling you she's an Asian female. But I think there's that, like, I think she feels a sense of, I can relate to her here, not just because she's done a PhD, but because she sort of understands the broader experience as well of being, I guess, looking different, sounding different.
Thank you so much. And maybe you could compare in the UK versus Australia?
Yeah, I think being in the UK has been interesting because, you know, I moved from home in Sydney to Canberra, where I did 4.5 years. I had like a half a year in Copenhagen, Denmark as an exchange in undergrad. And then I've lived in the UK this is my fifth year now. So it's kind of, you know, it's an extended time to be living in a different country. And I think people think that UK and Australia are very similar, because they both speak English and sort of there's a lot of overlap in certain demographic groups. And I think whilst that's true, it also means that you're not as prepared for some of the cultural differences. I still feel kind of a culture shock being here, just sort of the way people talk, certain expectations, general just like social norms. And so I think I've spent a lot of my time here thinking about myself as Australian. And Australia, I think, is still perceived, and I think still is objectively, quite white. And so I think, you know, I think people talk about like code switching. I think I code switch into being Australian and almost leaning a bit more into the whiteness just to make fitting in a little bit easier. So I think I don't really think about being Asian as much when I'm in the UK compared to being back home in Australia. And so recently I went back to Australia for 3 weeks over Christmas and New Year. And it's so diverse in terms of different culture backgrounds. I remember going to somewhere for brunch with my family and going to the toilet, and there was like, you know, signs in there in like 5 different languages about, you know, please wash your hands. But, you know, that was amazing. But obviously that doesn't mean it's some sort of, you know, mixing pot utopia. I think it also comes with it a lot of tensions. And I'm probably speaking about this a little 4 years out of date because that's kind of when I last lived there properly. But I think I still feel a little bit weird sometimes being in public spaces. Like, you know, my family and I, we went for a barbecue by the seaside, and just for reasons of logistics, we ended up doing it at the edge of the car park.
Oh no.
We still had a great view of the ocean. Don't get me wrong. That was actually a really, really good view of the ocean because we had this canopy that extended from the car. So we couldn't be too far away from the car, and there was no good place to park. But it was great. But then when people walk past, I think I just kept finding myself like bracing in a way for some sort of comment, you know, maybe some sort of race related comment. And I don't like that. And I don't know how much of that is a me problem, because no one ever said anything. You know, how much of that is just me holding on to past traumas and bad experiences, and how much of that is actually a fair expectation given where the society is now. So they're very complicated and very different things that I'm wrestling with in my mind, depending on where I am and sort of what identity I end up leaning into and adopting more, I think.
So I guess as we kind of look to wrap up, what about Jesus has most kind of been encouraging to you whilst thinking about this stuff, reflecting on it? Or what character of his has most excited you or encouraged you with all of this kind of going on?
I think, yeah, well, one of the things, as I mentioned before, of being really challenged in my work about handing things over to him, I think this sort of past year or two, it's been an ongoing challenge of handing things over to him, handing various aspects of my life over to him. And I think I always have this image in my mind of a clenched fist that he's trying to pry open finger by finger. But he's not doing it, you know, as another human might, of trying to control or dominate for the sake of it. He's doing it because, well, he knows the best way to go forward. He does it because he cares about all the big and little things. And I think that's what I often get lost at, because sometimes, yeah, it just feels like, oh, this is so trivial. Like, it should get done. It should just be easy, but it's not. And, you know, God doesn't have time to think about that. Whereas, well, God does, because he has infinite time. And God cares. And then there's no place more evident than on the cross of how much he cares about these, like, you know, little people down there who don't give anything about him. And I think also in terms of all our discussions on identity, yeah, I think being challenged to look upward, not just to look inward, to look up at him. Where does our identity sit? And yes, part of my identity is being, what is it, Asian female Christian scientist. But more importantly, it's a child of God, and it's, you know, someone that by Jesus' death he has redeemed. And because of that, that should be guiding how we go about each day. As to whether that happens or not, that is a constant wrestling. But, you know, God is, he's patient with us. And I know he's been trying to develop my patience recently in various things, but it's always good to be reminded that he's infinitely patient. Oh, actually, I was recently in my quiet times listening to Exodus, and God is very patient with them. You know, I'm listening to all the people, you know, Moses has led them out of Egypt at this point, and they're in the desert, and they're no longer, you know, they're not enslaved by the Egyptians, and they're still just complaining about everything. It's astounding how much they have to complain about, and how they're like, oh, I wish we were back in Egypt as slaves again. You're like, are you joking? But God doesn't go, fine, go do that. I don't care. I would, right, if I was in charge. I'll be like, all right, go satisfy yourselves. But God doesn't. God is so patient. God's like, okay, you know, here's water, here's bread from the sky, here's all these things. And these people have done nothing to deserve it. And it's so easy for us to look back at anywhere in the Bible and be like, oh, why is God bothering with these people? But that's what he does with us as well. We do that. But yeah, he's so good in all the ways that we're not. But that doesn't mean that we're beating ourselves up about it, because, you know, through the Holy Spirit, he is transforming us to be more like Christ. And I look forward to, yeah, all the transformations that he has in store for me.
Amen.
Thanks so much, Kay. It is so encouraging that God in his goodness and his sovereignty is working for our good, kind of making us more like Christ and for his glory. So yeah, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Look forward to chatting to you again.